Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Economics Design Podcast. Today, I'm very excited to be joined by my colleagues, Gio Populo and Nicholas Chandra, to discuss the fall of FTX. We're not going to be covering the basics of the story in detail because it's being covered by several media outlets, but what we're going to do instead is discuss some unique insights into the story that the economics design team has found out through its great investigative work. So that's going to be the focus of what we're going to be discussing today. Gio and Nicholas, thank you two for joining me. Could you two please introduce yourselves?
Absolutely. Very nice to be here again. I'm Gio, an associate consultant at Economics Design, and I work with the token design and economic incentives part of the projects here at Econs Design.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nicholas, and I'm a research analyst here at Economics Design. And mainly, I work on the product side of things. We're launching products, so stay tuned. And also working on generally blockchain analysis, data analysis, so we can have like insights on what's happening actually on the blockchain.
Great. So before we jump into things, I'll give a quick 2-minute summary of the FTX story and the most recent events, just to get everyone on the same page. So FTX is a centralized exchange, meaning it's a place where cryptocurrencies are bought and sold. And that was created by Sam Bankman-Fried, or SBF for short. So simply put, he and his team misallocated their customers' funds and committed fraud. What they did was they took their customers' money, gave it to Alameda Research, their sister company, who made risky crypto bets with it and lost it all. Once investors found out that their money was being mismanaged, people tried to remove their funds and couldn't. There's been approximately $10 billion of requested withdrawals that FTX does not have. They then filed for bankruptcy. And one of the things that's worth mentioning is the fact that Alameda provided the FTT token, which is basically the cryptocurrency of FTX, as collateral to a lot of lending institutions like Block Capital and Voyager. And these institutions are now in trouble because the collateral they received is directly tied to the success of FTX. Most recently, SBF has been arrested and the SEC has charged him with a variety of crimes related to fraud. So with that said, anything you two want to add to that explanation at all?
Yeah, I think this is like a very catastrophic event for crypto, just like we had Terra Luna. And there are a lot of critics of crypto ecosystem that just wait for these times to come after us and try to blame on the technology and whatever we're building here on the fault and on whatever happened. But I think this is like a perfect case of the difference between a code, a smart contract, something that just runs whatever is told to versus human misconduct. So I think people who are just blaming this at crypto as a whole, as a general, just don't understand the technology. And what happened here was a clear event of a fraud. It was a fraud just like any other in the traditional markets. And when you basically take your client's money or you create fake money using illiquidity as a reference point for that new mint, you're basically generating, you're creating fake bills, right? It's very similar to creating fake dollar bills. But what they did was with FTT tokens. So I think this is just to open. I think the most important thing is that people don't think of this event as a crypto specific thing or as a blockchain technology problem or anything like that, because it was purely human misconduct and a lack of reporting, lack of compliance, and just a lack of a lot of procedures that should be present in any company, any industry. So, yeah.
Yeah. And one thing to add to that, perhaps the criticism here is that the Web3 market or Web3 industry are not holding companies and exchanges to a high enough legal standard to declare and to basically make their practices public or adhere to these better practices of risk management, right? That's, I think, the overarching issue here is the narrative and the perspective of the users, right? Because it's the expectation that people will typically follow. But I mean, fraud is fraud, as you mentioned, Gio.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add to what you just said, because it's interesting, because I agree that most Web3 projects don't have the oversight that it should, because it's just a very new industry. We don't have the rules yet, the guidelines. So we're building this as we go. But interestingly, FTX was maybe the closest company to the regulators, closest company to big funds that had like really deeply rooted relationships with these big players from traditional markets. So it really like shocks me that the due diligence wasn't really done properly by these guys. Like, they're professionals at doing that. And FTX had enough oversight so to people to find that out. Like, it wasn't a very complex fraud that they made. It was very simple. Like, they didn't have the funds at hand. So it's just very interesting that this happened with a company that is not shady at all. It's like it was the preferred company for regulators, right? So most oversight we had, and people were just didn't see that. So it's an interesting thing to keep in mind as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. So let's dive into the conversation about what the most recent events of the story is. So Gio, you published an article that includes the unique findings from the data analytics that the economics design team has produced. I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about this article.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think what we wanted to do with the article was kind of summarize what happened with our own words and also give a sense of future possibilities of this, future consequences of this event. And the article is pretty well split into a couple of timings or periods per se. And I think the most interesting ones, and Nicholas is going to talk about more on the data of this, but I think we have three big events or periods there that are the first Alameda balance sheet. So whenever the CoinDesk article came out, and it revealed some of the leaked financial information about Alameda's balance sheet, I think that was the first alarm. So people saw that things weren't as clear as they thought they were. And then the second period, which was the CZ tweet, which was the second alarm we had. So it was when most of the crypto community came out and started actually raising questions and raising concerns regarding FTX. Kind of, I see it as a last attempt, the M&A discussion with Binance and FTX with the following withdrawal halt. So in our paper, we try to look at these big periods of time in a very short period, of course. These are like 3 days or like 5 days, but really relevant things happening at the same time. And at the end, we try to look at future outlooks. And I'll mention a couple of them during our conversation here. But yeah, if you want to add anything, Nicholas, feel free.
Oh, right. So yeah, I mean, about the article, a few findings were made actually. And mostly, yes, it's as what you said, Joe. So we try to split the data into these critical periods where SBF was raising funds in the Middle East, and then the CoinDesk report actually made the headlines, and also when Binance pulling out of the deal, and actually a lot of transactions were made on chain, and we can see like the addresses that made these transactions, and we can see like some of these addresses actually have institutional ties, and they interact with addresses that are known as wallets that belong to institutions. And actually, like some of these addresses, they don't withdraw anymore after Binance pulled out from the deal. So there might be some indication of insider trading, like some information that is not public, but certain kind of people, they know about it. And also, it indicates that the funds are fully withdrawn from FTX wallet before Binance announced that they are not going to save FTX anymore. So quite a lot of interesting findings just by looking at the blockchain data.
Yeah, just to add a little bit on that, it's interesting because we would expect that these events that we mentioned, so CZ's tweet or the M&A attempt announcement or CoinDesk article, would be the triggers for the public to actually change the fundamentals for that operation and start withdrawing, let's say. But when we look at on-chain data, it's super interesting that we have very relevant movements before anything like that. So before CoinDesk article, or even like after they halted withdrawals, we saw also some withdrawals. So there's stuff that is like, it doesn't really fit with what it should in terms of a story of a narrative. So yeah, what Nicholas mentioned is something that really suggests that insider information or people familiar with the matter were more aware of how deep was this hole.
Mm-hmm. And also, just for the listeners, I want to let you guys know that the article is going to be linked in the bio. So if you want to check out some of the cool graphs that we have and some of the statistics, you can definitely check it out there. So let's move into another section of essentially, you know, the paragraph or the article that's been written. Gio, do you want to explain a little bit more about like kind of that middle section there and some of the key points that are talked about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, so again, I'm going to be touching on the big alarms that we had. And I think the first one and the one that started all of that was Alameda balance sheet, as I mentioned. So CoinDesk reported that they had around $14 billion in assets. The critical part was that a lot of it was in FTT. So they did have a lot of assets, but around like 40% was in their own token, or not their own, because Alameda should be a separate entity, but its parent company, FTX, native token. So pretty much what they were saying, they were seeing is that they do have a lot of assets, but most of those were created by their own company, or at least are like backed by the other company's assets. And when we look at a balance sheet that is as big as Alameda's, like $14 billion, that's a lot of money. And when we think about client funds in FTX, that's also a very huge amount. So if you link those two and you start using one as a collateral for the other, or you start interchanging the value of those, you can really get into a hole that is hard to come out. And that's exactly what happened. So once everyone wanted to pull out, they didn't have the liquidity or the speed to actually get the funds, because they put funds on illiquid operations, like, I don't know, like a Solana fundraise or things like that. So that was the first alarm that came out, was that first they have assets that are backed by their own native token. And this was something that came out very quickly. And then after that, I think what really made people pull out at record speed was CZ, right? So when CZ said, hey, us as a Binance, we had a lot of tokens from old operations, but now we're going to liquidate all of them. This really raises a big, big red light for consumers. Like if a big investor is selling, what should I do, right? So it's similar to, I don't know, like Warren Buffett selling all of his stocks of certain company. People are going to see like, hey, he's one of the biggest investors. What's going on? So that's what really accelerated the withdrawals, but they were already happening. People were taking this, were getting to these conclusions on their own. And then lastly, I think it's interesting, the M&A attempt and the withdrawal halts. The M&A attempt, when it came out, it was something that I actually found it funny. I worked at M&A, and the way and the speed that things were announced were just unfeasible. Like, one day, SBF was saying that CZ was coming after them, trying to put a competitor down. And the other day, he said that they signed an LOI. And considering the size of the funds that work with FTX, like Sequoia, Pintera Capital, it's hard to imagine that SBF was able to sit with each one of these investors and to say what he was thinking, what were the terms, and get them to agree so quick. So I kind of almost certain that this M&A wouldn't go forward. So that was also interesting, because right after it came down and the deal fell through, things accelerated even more. Because now it's like, okay, we don't have a saver anymore. We're on our own. So I think this is like the bulk of the context of what happened.
Nicholas, do you want to jump in here and share a little bit more about the data analytics involved in understanding this whole situation?
Oh, sure. So the data was collected and analyzed directly from the blockchain. So at first, we would identify the addresses that are tied to FTX to keep track of the flow of money from and to the exchange. And then basically, we scour the Ethereum blockchain to collect the transactions. And then we note like these top addresses that are interacting with the exchange. And like if we order them, and if we try to order them by size, and we would find these interesting observations, because like some of these addresses, they are actually interacting with addresses that are labeled as, let's say, institutional addresses on Etherscan. And then so from there we can make deductions about the address based on their trading pattern and also other addresses that they are interacting with. So there are different patterns in the three periods, basically before the CoinDesk report and SBF raising funds in the Middle East, and then before CZ's tweet of pulling out from the FTX deal, and after that. So interestingly, I think retail didn't really catch up on the CZ tweet straight away. So it took like about a few hours for retail to have like massive panic and the withdrawal volume just spikes up. So
yeah. And a detail from that is interesting because I'm not sure if it's mentioned in the article, but a couple minutes after CZ tweeted that Binance was going to liquidate his positions, Carolyn, who was the CEO of Alameda, actually replied to him saying, hey, like Alameda would be very happy to buy it at $22. And I think that kind of statement of confidence made people at least hold for a couple hours to see what was going to happen. Because by that time, it had already fallen to like 21. From around 25, and she said, hey, we're happy to buy it at 22. So people maybe thought that if they still had firepower left, they would still try to hold around that price, either because of liquidations or because of their operations, how they were set. But there was this reference price of $22. So this is actually interesting that Nicholas said, because it took a couple hours, and I believe that Caroline's statement really had a play in that.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, interesting. It's always interesting looking at on-chain data to really tell a story because, you know, a lot of the times in traditional finance, we don't have that information publicly available to run the analysis. It's one of those really cool things that blockchain technology unlocks. It's a great use case. And it's actually true also in the gaming space. You know, I've spoken to the Shrapnel team about this, and they mentioned that it's great to be able to see all the transactions on-chain and be able to analyze it and draw some really cool conclusions from it. So very excited to be able to have this conversation due to the fact that we're using this technology.
And again, I think this issue really raises a concern on what you just mentioned, because FTX or any centralized exchange pretty much is a black box. So it's you don't know what's happening in there. Like maybe when they interact with the blockchain, you see that and they can't change that. But whatever is happening inside their own machine, their own money factory, we don't know exactly. So it's just like a bank. You don't know, after you deposit, you don't know the flow of your money. You don't know if they lent your money to someone else. You don't know if they're holding it. You don't know if, you just don't know. And that's the nature of centralized entities. And I think that we're going to get to this in the conclusions, but I think this really plays out on the side of DeFi. I think it's just a great takeaway from this event on how DeFi changes the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think DeFi, you know, it has some really interesting elements to it. And I think, you know, I think often there's the case that there's an argument to be made that, oh, blockchain enables a higher level of transparency. Well, we've seen it to be true that this is the case, but it's also a lot of the time not the case. It really just depends on the circumstances, because if you have one small aspect or even a large aspect of a product or whatever it is that's open and decentralized, maybe there's some small other aspect that isn't, and therefore the whole entire thing is no longer decentralized or visible. It's a very common trend you'll see in the Web3 spaces, these things that are so-called claimed to be decentralized or things like this, but in reality aren't.
Yeah, exactly. I agree.
Cool. So let's go on to the concluding section of the report. Joe, do you want to just run down exactly what were the main takeaways?
Yeah. We mentioned a couple of them. So I'm going to start with the one that I just mentioned. I think DeFi protocols really gain a lot of strength in their narrative, in their selling point. Even in the stress test that we had, big drops in market or even like Terra Luna things, with DeFi protocols weren't really affected. You know, like if you had a loan that was opened and you got under your collateral required, you got liquidated. And that's just how it is. And you didn't have an option to renegotiate your debt or to increase the interest that you're going to pay and push it forward for another 12 months. Like, it doesn't work like that. It's DeFi. Code is law. And I think this is something that really comes out stronger from this event, because we're going to see that people are going to opt in for decentralized protocols more than centralized. And even though this has been talked about in the crypto industry for like years and years, people still don't see the risk in centralized exchanges. People still really trust banks, traditional banks. And the more we see things happening because of the nature, as we said, the black box nature that we don't know what's happening in there, I think DeFi protocols are going to gain relevance. So this is the first consequence that I see coming from that. The second one, but in terms of priority or relevance, I think it's the top one, is transparency and regulation. So regulators are going to come for decentralized exchanges and anyone who basically does custody, like other people's money, and they custody they do the custody of this money, regulators are going to come from them for them at record speeds, I think. So Binance is next in line. We see that now with FTX hearings and a bunch of things happening, people are starting to turn their eyes to Binance and try to blame them as well to everything that is happening, and to try to paint a picture of them to be just as a monster like FTX was. And this is going to just lead into a lot of new regulatory guidelines for them. So yeah, this is the second thing that I see coming from that. And the third one, and I think it's maybe the best one when we think of the philosophy of crypto, is the importance of self-custody. So how important it is for us to know how to do our own custody of our money. So if you have a hard wallet, if you have a MetaMask and you have a clean computer, why would you keep your funds in Binance, or why would you keep your funds in FTX or any other centralized exchange, right? So like, if you can't keep your funds, why would you delegate this to someone else? If you don't know how to do self-custody, learn from it and then do it. So I think that's the third and also very important conclusion that I got from this event.
Mm-hmm. So the self-custody thing is an interesting point. At the current moment in time, right, with the development of MetaMask and these personal wallets, there are risks to both, right? So, I mean, if you're not familiar with, you know, clickbait scams, essentially a bunch of scams that you can, you know, click on a link and then, oh, your wallet's been compromised. Like, this is an issue that is true currently and likely will remain an issue until things continue to develop. So, unfortunately, at this moment, there are like, both situations are not ideal, unfortunately, right? So hopefully we see this trend improved. Nicholas, is there anything you want to contribute or add on to the data analytic process that was involved? Any key takeaways or practices that were relevant to our listeners that they might be able to use to do their own research?
Oh, yes, of course. So actually, in the article, actually, we have noted like the addresses that are making a lot of transactions or notable, very notable, like withdrawals from FTX. And I think like the institutions that are related to these wallets, or even like the addresses themselves, we can keep track of them in the future and where the money flows, where the money goes. So yeah, I mean, these whales, they might have some information that we don't, and we can actually leverage on what we know of them right now. In the future, maybe we can make our own inferences, because like at this point, like there might be some missing links and not like 100% of the truth could be extracted. But, you know, just by looking at these addresses, it might give us like some kind of advantage in the future in terms of, you know, if you want to make some predictions on the market and so on and so forth. So yeah,
and also to add, I think these notable wallet addresses is something that when you're doing the forensics to try to find the flow of the money, it's funny because a lot of times you just hit a wall and there's nowhere else. It's like a newly created wallet that hasn't transacted with anyone or anywhere, and who got the funds from, I don't know, let's say a withdrawal after it was halted. So If someone withdrew after they were blocked, they probably have a privilege somehow, or connections, or some special treatment. But then if these funds flow to an empty wallet, where do you go from there, right? It's like a 0x3b, and you can't identify whoever that is. So these notable wallets are super important for us to keep in mind, because if someone wants to take advantage of that, they will have to move it somehow, and they have to send it to them somehow or somewhere. So I think it's good to keep in mind those wallet addresses so that we keep track of them if they're involved in new things. So if you see one of those wallets, I don't know, creating a project, that's a red light, right? So just to keep in mind and to track future activities.
Yeah. All right. Thank you too for joining me on the podcast today.
Absolutely. Thank you for inviting me.
All right. Thanks, everyone.